From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The music we're listening to features the Stan Getz Quartet with the young Gary Burton on vibes. The session was recorded in 1964, but it wasn't released until last year. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, Stan Getz and Gary Burton. We feature an interview with Getz, recorded the year before his death in 1991. And we'll hear an interview from last year with Burton. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Braveheart, starring Mel Gibson, who also directed the film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Defense Secretary William Perry says he's outraged at the taking of United Nations workers hostage by Bosnian Serbs to use as human shields. The Serbs are retaliating for a series of airstrikes yesterday and today. Perry says the tactic must stop. President Clinton has announced his firm support for the airstrikes, which he said were needed to force the Bosnian Serbs to stop shelling Sarajevo. But the NATO raids have prompted the Serbs to attack even more UN-declared safe havens in several Bosnian towns. Surgeon General nominee Henry Foster has been approved by the Senate Committee on Labor and Human Resources. The committee voted 9-7 to recommend that Dr. Foster's nomination be forwarded to the full Senate for confirmation. The key vote for Foster came from a fellow doctor and Tennessean, Senator Bill Frist. The senator says he left out political considerations and looked at Foster's qualifications for office.
Does this man have the commitment? Have the competence, have the intelligence, have the training, and have the integrity to be the chief spokesman for Americans on issues concerning public health. These are the issues that I've considered, and I'm satisfied with what I've seen.
Foster's nomination still faces obstacles. Majority Leader Bob Dole hasn't decided if he'll bring the nomination to a Senate floor vote, and Texas Republican Phil Graham is threatening a filibuster. Both men are presidential candidates. A man who was questioned in connection with the Oklahoma City bombing has agreed to be transferred from Arizona to California, where he faces a weapons charge. As Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ reports, lawyers for Stephen Colburn continue to maintain he was not involved in the bombing.
Stephen Colburn was taken into custody in Oatman, Arizona earlier this month and charged with resisting arrest and carrying a weapon while a fugitive. Law enforcement officials reportedly wanted to question Colburn about Oklahoma City bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh. But Colburn's attorney, John Hanna, says media reports have created a mistaken impression that Colburn is talking about the case.
There's been a lot of speculation about his cooperating with the authorities. That kind of speculation endangers his safety in the prison system, and I wish y'all would stop that.
Hanna says Colburn did agree to an interview with federal authorities to clear himself of allegations that he was somehow connected to the Oklahoma City bombing. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker says he's been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury investigating the Whitewater case. The subpoena was issued by Whitewater Special Counsel Kenneth Starr. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 47 points at 4,365. This is NPR. Philip Morris Companies Incorporated has launched a voluntary recall of several major cigarette brands, including Marlboro. Philip Morris says defective filters in a small percentage of the cigarettes may cause eye, nose, and throat irritation and dizziness among smokers. The tobacco company says the defective filters were made with contaminated material that has since been purged from its plants. The contamination does not affect international brands. For the first time in more than a century, Texans will be allowed to carry concealed handguns. Although permits will not be issued for several months, gun store owners are seeing brisk business. Leah Parker of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
Texas Governor George W. Bush has signed the controversial bill into law. It was one of his campaign promises in his race against then-Governor Ann Richards, who vetoed a similar bill 2 years ago. Permits will be issued September 1st after a background check and 10 to 15 hours of training. Opponents argue that more guns on the streets equate to more violence and death. But gun store owner Lori Carter says it's a way for people to protect themselves.
With the number of people that are calling wanting the training, I mean, to me, it shows, kind of typifies that Texas spirit that people want the education. I think that they'll be more responsible. And if people are willing to go through that much trouble, 10 to 15 hours of training, I think that they're going to use it more wisely.
Concealed guns are not allowed in bars, hospitals, churches, or places that sell alcohol. For National Public Radio, I'm Leah Parker in Houston.
A government report says 5 out of 8 pregnancies in the United States during 1992 resulted in live births. The National Center for Health Statistics says of more than 6 million pregnancies that year, nearly a third ended in abortions, miscarriages, and stillbirths. The report says abortion rates fell 12% between 1980 and 92. That's attributed to the fewer number of women in their late teens to their early 20s. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of the show, we have a 1994 interview with Gary Burton, one of the great jazz vibraphonists. Self-taught on the instrument, he became a technical innovator as well as a lyrical interpreter. In the 60s, he was a pioneer of jazz fusion. In the 70s, while recording for the ECM record label, he helped create the reflective sound that label became known for. Since 1971, he's taught at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, where he's now dean of curriculum. Back in the 60s, he studied at Berklee, but he left the school to go on the road with George Shearing and then Stan Getz. Now Burton is one of the very few jazz musicians who is out of the closet as a gay man. Before we meet him, let's hear some music. This is from one of my favorite Burton albums, Dream So Real, featuring compositions by Carla Bley. Gary Burton, welcome to Fresh Air. The vibes is a very uncommon instrument to start out on when you're young. I mean, you know, lots of families have pianos, lots of kids have guitars. You can get a trumpet in school, but the vibes, I don't know how you get access to it. How did you?
It was kind of coincidental. My older sister already played the piano, and my parents wanted me to take music lessons too. I was about 6 years old at that time. And so they said, well, pick something different. And in taking me around to see other instruments at school concerts and that sort of thing, one of the things we went to was a recital by a lady who played the marimba, which is a close relative of the vibraphone. So that's what I picked. I think probably because it was big and you hit it with sticks, you know, I'm sure I didn't have much criteria for making a reasonable judgment at that age. It was kind of just instinctive. And started playing the marimba, and then a year or so later added the vibraphone as well, and played both for quite a few years until I got interested in jazz. And since jazz and vibraphone go together, from that point on, all I wanted to do was play jazz, and I just stuck with the vibes.
How old were you when your parents actually bought you a vibraphone?
Oh, I was, marimba when I was 6, and vibraphone, let's say I was probably 7 or 8.
They must have had confidence in you to spend that kind of money on what I'm sure was a very exotic instrument.
I suppose so. At the time, it seemed perfectly reasonable. I assumed that parents were doing this all over the place with
their
children.
Not in my neighborhood.
But I discovered as I got older that there were practically no other players of mallet instruments anywhere. And in fact, I never really saw a professional vibraphone player until I had gone all the way through high school and moved to Boston to go to college. I grew up in Indiana, so there weren't a lot of jazz musicians around, and particularly not vibraphone players.
Well, what were you listening to get a sense of how the vibe sounded before you started listening to jazz?
I really wasn't listening to anything. You know, this was the 50s, and people weren't as used to nonstop all day long listening to music as is now the custom. And I just played what music I could get my hands on. Usually it was sheet music from the music store that was written for piano, and I would sort of adapt it to the marimba or the vibraphone. And just learned lots of songs and played kind of concerts locally and around where I lived. And when I got interested in jazz, it was first sort of through Dixieland music. Benny Goodman was one of the first jazz musicians I remember hearing. But when I got into jazz, then I started a love affair with records and started driving, you know, an hour or two away to larger cities to find record stores to look through the jazz selection to see what I could take home.
When you started listening to Lionel Hampton or Red Norvo or Milt Jackson, was it a revelation?
Kind of, because first thing I discovered was that I didn't play technically like the established players. Milt Jackson was the most famous vibist of that day and still is a major star on the instrument. And at the time, his style, you know, he is a two-mallet player. And I had been playing with four mallets because I played alone all the time and it was too empty without some harmony. And I wanted it to sound more complete, so I had continued experimenting with four mallets and learned to play the instrument somewhat as a solo instrument and as treating it as a keyboard instrument. And when I finally heard other players and saw them play later on, I realized that my approach was drastically different from the norm. And in fact, instead of becoming influenced by other vibraphone players, I turned to piano players to be my influences. And probably I could list three or four piano players who were the most important in terms of shaping my style of playing.
Did you do anything that would have been considered wrong? If you had a teacher, would your teacher have tried to talk you out of things that you are still doing now?
Probably not. The one thing that the people did tell me when I did ever meet a mallet player or read anything about it was the admonition that four mallet playing was impractical and had no future. But I had already been doing it enough up to that point that I didn't think that was true. I was finding that, in fact, it was a lot easier than it first appeared to be, that once you reached a certain point with it, it became pretty fluent and pretty natural. And so I sort of disproved the conventional wisdom of the time, which was that two mallets was the only way to play the instrument. You have to realize that the vibraphone is still a very young instrument as instruments go. It was invented in 1929 and didn't really get fully established until the 40s. So when I started playing it, it was only 20 years old as an instrument, and the technical possibilities for it were still waiting to be discovered in a lot of ways.
You use usually two mallets in each hand.
Right.
Does the relationship of one mallet to the other in one hand remain constant? Are you always playing the same interval?
No, they're changing.
Hand?
They're you think of them, in fact, as fingers. It's as if I'm playing a large piano keyboard and I've got four fingers and I'm constantly changing the positioning of the four mallets or these four fingers to make different chord combinations. And I use them singly as well to play single notes. It's not always just four-note chords that are going down. It's a constant variety between single lines and contrapuntal lines and voicings that may be two notes, three notes, or four notes.
One of the first bands you went on the road with was Stan Getz. Pretty lucky break, I guess, to get started like that. But Getz has the reputation of being maybe moody would be a good a good word here.
I see you're up on your jazz history.
So what was it like when you were a young man? I think you were still a teenager. Getting started with somebody who was A, that good, but B, that temperamental.
It was a real education. And in fact, even years later, when I would run into Stan, we would laugh about it. And I would tell him that, you know, what an experience it was to spend 3 years working with him, that in some ways he taught me all the things that I shouldn't do. In terms of how to approach my career.
You mean through his example?
Yeah, but at the same time, he was one of the most marvelous musicians and that I've ever known. And I learned so much from him, just from watching him play and how he dealt with the music and also how he dealt with his career. He was a very kind of intense and volatile person. So he was, you know, he really wore his emotions on his sleeve. And so that was a total opposite from me in just in personal approach to things. But it was a good education because Stan was representative of a type of artist. And I have met other people through the years who remind me of Stan. And whenever I find myself working with someone who is this type of artist, I always say, okay, I know how this works. I know how to deal with someone like this. I know how to work cooperatively with them because I had 3 years of experience with Stan, and that, you know, got me used to this.
Did he do anything to test you or to intimidate you early on?
Oh, immediately. the first encounter with him was sort of an audition. This was at a club in New York called Basin Street East, and he was actually looking for a piano player, but had been unable to find someone available and needed to find a replacement for the musician in his band. And someone had told him that I played vibraphone with four mallets and that perhaps I could substitute for piano. So he had called me up and told me to come down to the club with my vibraphone and sit in for a set and see what it sounded like. So I did, and it didn't go well at all. I didn't know many of the songs they were playing and or their arrangements, and I was kind of intimidated by Stan, who just his very presence sort of would make you nervous. And about halfway through the set, I was never sure when to accompany. I didn't want to get in the way because I didn't know the songs too well. So I would only play chords and comp occasionally just so he could sort of hear what it sounded like, but I didn't want to try to do too much and become a problem. But he apparently thought I was, holding back and so on. So at some point in the middle of the set, he got totally red-faced and turned to me and sort of yelled, how come you're not comping when I'm playing? You only comp when he's playing. Is there something wrong with my playing? And it so, terrified me that I could hardly play at all for the rest of the night. And he said, well, didn't work out, so thanks anyway. And I figured that was the end of it. But he called back a week later because he still hadn't found anyone, and he was desperate now because he had 3 weeks of dates booked that were to start a few days later. And so he called me back in desperation and asked me would I do it anyway, even though it was clear that he didn't like my playing. And because the other guys in the band were friends of mine, I thought, well, I'll have a good time anyway. It'll work out. I'll do it. And for the first week, he didn't like anything I did and would yell at me all through the times we were playing. He would tell me to lay out because when my playing would start to bother him, he would make me stop, then he'd play without me for a while. But by the end of the first week, I had begun to figure out how to fit into his band and what would work musically. And by the time the 3 weeks were up, it had settled into a nice combination, and so he said, well, why don't you stay on for the next tour? And then that ended up being for 3 years.
When he didn't like what you were playing and he told you to lay out, this was at a club in public?
Yeah, this was at, actually it was a tour of Canada. We were playing clubs in Montreal and Toronto, and so in the middle of the song he would turned to me and yelled the word stroll, which was kind of an old musician's term for the accompanying the comping instrument to lay out. It was called strolling.
Isn't that embarrassing, humiliating to be told that in front of an audience?
It was. I had quite a bit of pride in those days. I guess maybe I still do, although it's tempered somewhat through years of experience. But at the time, I was considered a hotshot student from Berkeley, and I thought I was quite the player. And to have him, clearly unhappy with my playing was kind of a new experience to me. Anyone else I'd ever played with before always seemed to be pretty happy with what I was doing. And it was kind of a strange experience to have somebody who was so visibly agitated by my playing. But I noticed something during that 3 weeks that was a big revelation to me and started changing my playing, and which Stan was responsible for. I noticed that there I was, the hot young player, and I would solo my heart out when it was my turn, and then I would watch Stan when it was his turn, and he would play a lot fewer notes than me and a lot simpler. In many cases, he would play almost just the original melody of the song, just kind of paraphrase it a little bit, but play it so expressively that I'd look at and the audience would just be totally captivated by what he was doing. And I woke up to the fact that there was something to do with how you handle melody that I hadn't really noticed or given attention to before. And I said, here's something I need to learn about, and this looks like the guy to learn it from. So it was an important time for me.
We're listening to a 1994 interview with Gary Burton. Later that year, a recording he made in 1964 with Stan Getz was released for the first time. The album is called Nobody Else But Me. Let's hear What Is This Thing Called Love. From a 1964 session, we heard Stan Getz on tenor, Gary Burton on vibes. We'll feature a 1990 interview with Getz on the second part of our show. We'll continue our Gary Burton interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1994 interview with vibraphonist Gary Burton.
You've done something that I think exceptionally few jazz musicians have done, and that is you've come out. And I believe you've been out at the Berklee School of Music, where you teach, for about 5 years. But I believe now you're kind of coming out in a more public way. And I was wondering why you feel ready to do that now.
Well, sort of a combination of my own personal timetable and this changing attitudes, I think. Earlier on, I didn't think that people were ready to deal with that. And jazz in particular has a very macho kind of image to it. And I felt that I didn't want to confuse people who were following my music and kind of mixing up my personal life with an image that might confuse them. And but as time has gone on, I have felt a greater desire to just be myself and you know, live openly what I am and who I am. And I also have felt increasingly comfortable with society's growing maturation on the subject, and felt like it would not be as drastic an issue. And so a few years ago, when I started being more open, first with friends and then where I work and people I play with, musician people in the industry and so on, I was very encouraged by the fact that I got nothing but supportive responses from people and encouragement from everyone. And that convinced me that it was the right thing to do. And it's certainly been a refreshing change in my life.
I've always assumed it must be difficult to come out in the jazz world, even to jazz musicians. And I reached that conclusion because there are so few jazz musicians who are out. I mean, I could maybe not think of any except for you. When everybody knows about some jazz musicians who are gay, and even those people who everybody knows about aren't out.
Well, I also wondered about that, the fact that there were no other musicians that were, at least that were well known, that were out. I know of a few, and I thought perhaps that my becoming more public about it would make it easier for others to deal with it.
Were you afraid that musicians wouldn't be accepting?
I was. I was worried about it, and I thought that, well, the worst that will happen is that a few of them will not want to work with me again, that I won't get called for some projects, and that I decided that, well, I guess after this many years, I would survive, and that I guess I would just have to deal with that, and that I was sure I wouldn't lose out on the chance to do, you know, all work, that I would still have some things that would be available. But I was really and frankly pleased to find that there was no change in my work pattern at all, that the same people were happy calling me up and happy working with me, and in fact would go out of their way to be supportive and encouraging and to tell me that they thought it was just great.
Had there been times before you came out when musicians would, you know, make fag jokes or put down people who...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how did you deal with that? What kinds of things came up, and how did you deal with it?
I think the way everyone who is keeping it a secret does, which is you have a way of ignoring it and tuning it out. You have a way of not taking it personally. It's funny, those kind of jokes never bothered me until I came out. And then suddenly when I would overhear some kind of fag joke, then I would feel offended, like they were talking about me. And I would laugh at that. I would say, how did I do that all those previous years when I would hear those kind of jokes? And I would think it didn't apply to me. And that's, you know, our curious way of denying things, I suppose, and protecting ourselves.
Vibraphonist Gary Burton, recorded last year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up from the archives, we feature an interview with the great tenor saxophonist Stan Getz, recorded the year before his death in 1991. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Braveheart, starring Mel Gibson, who also directed the film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Surgeon General nominee Henry Foster has been approved by the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee, but his confirmation is far from certain. President Clinton is asking senators to lay aside politics and take a full Senate vote on Dr. Foster. UPI's Bill Small reports.
In a brief Oval Office appearance, Mr. Clinton thanked members of the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee for their positive vote on Dr. Henry Foster's nomination to be Surgeon General. And the president called on Senate Republicans not to use a filibuster to block a final vote on Foster's nomination.
It would be unusual and unwarranted if this fine man were denied his day in court in the Senate. And I don't believe the American people want that to happen, and I don't believe that a majority of the Senate wants that to happen.
Mr. Clinton says even when Democrats were the majority party, they still allowed votes on the nominees of Republican presidents. And he says Republicans should do the same. Bill Small at the White House.
A published report says authorities are close to bringing charges against a third man in the Oklahoma City bombing. The Los Angeles Times says Michael Fortier is negotiating a plea bargain with the FBI as it seeks a broad conspiracy indictment. Fortier and suspect Timothy McVeigh became friends in Kingman, Arizona, where they worked in a hardware store. They'd served together in the Army. The Times reports Fortier is cooperating with authorities, and the Times says they've been discussing a written agreement under which Fortier would plead guilty to limited charges and then become a key government witness. The Justice Department will ask the Supreme Court to overturn Virginia Military Institute's men-only admission policy. A lower court ruling says the state can keep VMI all-male by setting up a military-style program for women at another school. Fred Eccles of member station WVTF has this report.
The government says the alternative program at Mary Baldwin College will not provide women the same benefits men derive from attending VMI. VMI spokesman Mike Strickler says the Justice Department's action was not unexpected.
This is kind of what we thought all along would happen, and that the case would go to the Supreme Court, and now we have to see whether they will hear the case.
Four of the nine Supreme Court justices must agree for the appeal to be heard. The nation's only other single-sex public college, the Citadel in South Carolina, is also under court order to provide an alternative for women. For National Public Radio, I'm Fred Eccles in Roanoke, Virginia.
The Coast Guard has closed 3 miles of the swollen Mississippi River. The river was blocked after a towboat and 35 barges struck a bridge linking southeastern Arkansas and Greenville, Mississippi. Crews are still trying to see if river traffic can navigate around them. Officials in both states say the area is a problem for barge traffic anyway, and high water from heavy rain is making matters worse. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. In unofficial figures, the Dow lost more than 43 points to close at 4,369. This is NPR. Jeep Cherokees and Dodge Ram pickups are the subject of a new recall. Chrysler says the owners of 175,000 1994 and 95 pickups are being told to have a hood latch bracket replaced. The company says they may not fasten properly. And about 70,000 1995 Cherokees need to have the driver's side airbags checked and possibly fixed. Chrysler says some don't have parts needed to make them deploy in an accident. There have been no reports of problems involving either of the two vehicles. Judges hearing domestic violence cases will now be able to educate themselves on the issue. Creators of a new CD-ROM program say although awareness of domestic violence is up, the sensitivity of judges doesn't necessarily follow. Harry Lynn of member station KQED reports from San Francisco.
Welcome to Domestic Violence, a virtual conference for judges in the criminal courts. The CD-ROM simulates a conference with seminars, workshops, and case studies. The creators, the San Francisco-based Family Violence Prevention Fund, will give the discs to judicial education programs around the country. Though using the discs won't be mandatory, Fund Director Esta Soler hopes enlightened judges will push along those who are less sensitive to the issue.
It's peer pressure and it's peer expectation.
The disc's creators say domestic violence cases are increasing, but judges often don't take them seriously enough. The CDs feature judges from Washington, D.C., Connecticut, Wisconsin, Washington, and California. For National Public Radio, I'm Harry Lynn in San Francisco.
Medical experts from the World Health Organization say they think the acute phase of the Ebola epidemic in Zaire is over. A spokesman says the agency plans to pull out 4 or 5 experts who've been working to halt the disease's spread. The spokesman says there's been no significant increase in the number of cases in recent days. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the first part of our show, Gary Burton told us how intimidated he was as a young musician playing with the demanding and temperamental Stan Getz. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1990 interview with the great tenor saxophonist. A year after our interview was recorded, Getz died in June of 1991 at the age of 64. He died of cancer, which he'd had for 4 years. Getz gained popularity in both the worlds of jazz and pop. In the 1950s and 60s, he was a perennial poll winner in the jazz magazines. In 1962 and 64, he landed in the top 40 with his bossa nova hits Desafinado and The Girl from Ipanema, which started the Brazilian music craze in the United States. Getz won 11 Grammys during his career. Jazz critic Francis Davis described Getz as one of the most lyrical soloists in jazz. When I spoke with Getz in 1990, he told me he had very little in the way of formal music lessons.
I took a few saxophone lessons in the beginning, but that's about all. I went on the road when I was 15, and everything I've learned has been in what you might call the traveling academies.
Yeah, right. Who showed you the most when you were young and on the road?
I think the very first band leader, Jack Teagarden. He was an amazing, wonderful musician. And Benny Goodman. And then Woody Herman's band, we had a great band. I was about, 19, 20 years old, and I learned a lot on that band. And ever since then, I've had my own band.
You know, when you were on the road with Teagarden, I think you were 16 years old, and if I have the story straight, you had dropped out of high school, and a truant officer tracked you down on the road with Teagarden's band. And then Teagarden ended up becoming your legal guardian for a while so that you could stay on the road and not go back to high school?
That's right.
How did the truant officer find you?
Oh, I don't know. But I guess... I never thought of that. I don't know how he found me. He found me... I went to school in New York. He found me in St. Louis. But he found me, and Teagarden had a promise that he would make sure I got my lessons. And I sure did, but I don't know if it's the kind of lessons that the truant officer meant for me to have.
How did you end up joining Woody Herman's band?
I had left Benny Goodman's band and was out on the coast, and we put together a little three-tenor band in the L.A. area, and Woody heard about it. In the band were Zoot Sims and Herbie Stewart, and... Jimmy Giuffre and myself, and Woody heard about us and hired us en masse to go with the second herd he was forming after he'd disbanded the first.
The saxophone section became known as the Four Brothers.
Correct. Well, it wasn't originally titled The Four Brothers. It was titled The Four Mothers.
Oh, really? Got it.
But we couldn't use it that way at the time, so it became Brothers. But now you could say Four Mothers.
Uh-huh. Well, what was it like for you being in such a great section? You know, I don't know how many bands have such a good horn section.
It was a great band. I mean, it's been one thrill after another in this business with the musicians I've played with and the places I've been. Keeps you young.
It was in the early 1950s, I think, that you went out on your own, started your own band. Was it a big responsibility when you were younger to have bands on your own and have to worry about,
you know, paying the musicians and the bands when you were on gigs and stuff like that?
It was. I was totally unprepared and ill-equipped for it. But because I had a chance to play with whom I wanted to in the rhythm section, in rhythm sections, and to play the music I wanted to exactly as the way I wanted to, it was a great thrill. So the lack of money meant nothing. We just made it somehow, and we kept going on and on.
Let me play one of your early recordings with your own group. This is a 1952 session of Body and Soul. And playing with you is Duke Jordan at the piano, Jimmy Rainey guitar, Bill Crow bass, and Frank Asola drums. This is Body and Soul, recorded in 1952. Body and Soul, my guest Stan Getz on tenor saxophone. Do you have good memories of this session?
Yeah, I do. It was my first session for the Verve label. First time I met Norman Granz, and that started a 20-year relationship with the Verve, which was bought by Polygram, and now they still put it out under the Verve name. I have 80 records on that label.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with the late tenor saxophonist Stan Getz. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Stan Getz. A lot of musicians in the 1950s ended up getting hooked on heroin. And from what I've heard, one of the things I've heard from a lot of musicians is that they saw the musicians they looked up to doing drugs and ended up doing them themselves, and partially in an attempt to emulate their heroes and also thinking that maybe they'd sound better. And I know you had a drug problem in your teens and in part of your 20s. And I was wondering how you got involved with that.
You know, I think as I look back on it, that musicians use drugs and alcohol for two reasons. One of the reasons is the same reason as why doctors have used morphine. Because when you get tired, morphine is a work drug. As long as you don't take too much of it, it'll keep you going. Alcohol is a temporary stimulant before it's a depressant. I think that was one reason, because we traveled and worked very hard, and it was there. I didn't look to any idols for the reason why I would take drugs so it would make me play better. That's nonsense. The other reason is that there's a state of mind that you need to do anything in the art forms. It's called the alpha state. Delta is pure sleep. That's another state, brain waves. And there's delta, there's theta, which is meditation. And alpha is the one state of mind that you do to go into creating something. It's sort of like thinking off the top of your head, relaxed concentration. And when you can't get that naturally, if you're too tired or something, you might resort to alcohol, drugs, to chocolate, to food, anything that will give you a chance to get into alpha, to relax and think, but not really think like, say, an accountant would think, but think in the artistic sense of the word. That's the reason I use stuff.
You ended up in prison for a while. How were you busted?
I had needle marks on my arm, which is a law that since has been declared unconstitutional. It was a misdemeanor, first offense, but it seems that the judge's son had gotten into the same trouble, and he was angry, and he gave me 180 days hard time, first offense on a misdemeanor, and 3 years probation. So all for the best, I think. No pain, no gain in this life.
So you were in prison just for having needle marks?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of prison were you in?
The L.A. holding jail, L.A. County Jail. It's the kind of jail where it's not an institution. It's where people who can't make bail rot in the cell.
Is that what you felt you were doing, is rotting in the cell?
Of course it was. That's what we were all doing. And it was an overcrowded jail.
Did you have to kick in jail?
Yeah.
What'd you do when you got out?
What I do, I played and was very happy. I played music 4 days after I got out. After not touching my horn, they took it away in jail. I played a concert at the Shrine Auditorium for 7,000 people.
You were the musician in the 60s most responsible for popularizing Brazilian music in the United States, especially your albums with Wild Gilberto and work with Carlos Jobim. The biggest hit, I think, was Girl from Ipanema. What got you interested in Brazilian music?
The beauty of it.
Had you traveled down there?
Never been to Brazil when I made those records. A lot of people think I'm Brazilian.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm from North Brazil, the Bronx. No, it's just beautiful music with very, very suggestive, laid-back rhythms. And the melodies are beautiful and sad and romantic. It's a folk music. All folk music is beautiful. And it goes perfectly with jazz. So, there you are.
Let me play what was probably your biggest bossa nova hit, The Girl from Ipanema, probably the single record that had the biggest effect on Americans in the 60s in terms of Brazilian music.
Smiles, but she doesn't see.
Stan Getz and his version of Girl from Ipanema. Now, when you ended up on the pop charts, were you surprised?
Oh, was I ever. I recorded the music because I thought it was beautiful, and here it turns out to be commercially very viable. And I was amazed.
How do you think your sound has changed over the years?
It's gotten gutsier. It's more direct. It isn't as pretty. It's not as feminine.
What do you mean by feminine?
Oh, sort of light, airy, effeminate. It has more substance, and it's more direct.
How did you start playing in the upper register a lot?
I think I played the lead tenor part with Woody Herman's band.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was up above everybody else, and I sort of got used to it. And I think then when I got a quartet, too, we used to play in noisy clubs, people drinking, and I'd have to play in the upper register, it seems, to be heard as a lead voice with over a rhythm section. And then again, maybe I just like it. I don't play nearly as much in the upper register as I used to.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Stan Getz. Most of your life you've been on and off the road, touring, traveling. How do you like life on the road?
Physically and emotionally, it can be wearing. But there's one thing that makes it all worthwhile, and that's that you do get up to play music in different towns for different people. So all the inconvenience you put up with is canceled out by that one main thing, the reason why you're there.
Mm-hmm. You have a family. You have married.
Well, they're
several
all grown
children.
Now.
Yeah, but when you were younger, was it hard to leave the family and go on the road?
Oh, my family life probably suffered from it, I'm sure. What could I do? It seems my life has been music. And the constant search for it is in some ways been the mainspring of my life. What can I do?
Stan Getz recorded in June of 1990. He died of cancer 1 year later. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about what's happened in Bosnia most recently, also European reaction to the latest exchange of NATO airstrikes the other day, and we'll be hearing the responses as well from the Bosnian Serbs and from the Bosnian government. Also on today's program, Wade Goodwin reports on the progress of the investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing. We'll hear news of the approval by Senate Committee of the nomination of Henry Foster to be Surgeon General, what Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition thinks of that. And we'll also be talking with Frankie Manning, who is 81 years old today. He was the king of the Lindy Hop many years ago and the first man to throw his partner over his back.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mel Gibson's career as a movie hunk has long been assured, but recently he began directing his own films as well. And his first movie as a director, The Man Without a Face, was something less than a resounding success. Still, if you're Mel Gibson, you get to do what you want. And now he's back with his second directorial effort, a 3-hour epic about the medieval Scottish rebel leader William Wallace. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Braveheart.
Sometimes there are reasons for the wonders Hollywood visits upon us, and sometimes there aren't. The reasons behind the appearance of two big movies about Scottish rebels within 3 months of each other are a case for the X-Files. But I will say this. Rob Roy bored the kilt off me. And Braveheart, even though it's nearly an hour longer, is a real rouser. The cornball Mel Gibson, who gave us The Man Without a Face 2 years ago, is still in evidence here. This movie may be based on actual events, but it's corn from start to finish. And for the first half hour, when we meet the hero William Wallace as a boy in the late 13th century and watch him grow up and romance his childhood sweetheart, the corn grows so overripe that you may feel like riding through the screen with a thresher. But once Wallace begins to fight the evil English and Scotland rallies behind him, the movie visibly grows in stature. Gibson isn't a very original director. We've seen his best tricks already in the work of Kurosawa, Peckinpah, and Kenneth Branagh. But he's very good at making all that hacking and hewing and beheading exciting. And by the time he builds up to the Battle of Stirling, at which William Wallace and a ragtag band of peasants face the combined might of the English cavalry, archers, and infantry, Gibson has developed an unstoppable head of steam. Here he is lathering up his troops before the charge.
You've come to fight as free men. Free men you are. What will you do without freedom? Will you fight?
Fight against that? No! We will run!
And we will live. Aye. Fight and you may die.
run, and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
There's an awful lot of pious speechifying about freedom in this movie, and Gibson and his screenwriter, named of all things Randall Wallace, lay it on thicker as the movie progresses. By the end, when they combine still more talk about freedom with a heavy-duty torture scene, you may find the masochism of it all a little sick-making. But between speeches, Braveheart really works. The Battle of Stirling is historical poppycock, but it's a magnificent scene, clearly staged and full of suspense. In fact, the movie's full of historical inaccuracies, and none of them matter. Gibson and Wallace have created a kind of Marxist view of Scottish history, in which class outweighs national solidarity, and the political twists and turns that the filmmakers have built into the plot are almost as diverting as the battle scenes. Above it all, Gibson himself rides like the road warrior in tartans, his face painted a blue that matches his eyes. Gibson's jocular, prankish acting style has always been an odd fit with his action movie heroics, but here his two halves work together seamlessly. He holds the screen like a friendlier, less forbidding Kirk Douglas or Charlton Heston. Whatever missteps Gibson may have made in recent years, Braveheart establishes him once again as a real movie star, and, for the first time, as a real movie director as well.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was co-produced by Roberta Shorrock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Oswald's Tale, An American Mystery by Norman Mailer. This is NPR, National Public Radio.